My name is Mark Presidis. I'm the Director of Creative Writing here. And on behalf of our wonderful English department, and our Chair, John Ernest, our Associate Chair, Tim Sweet, and the members of the Creative Writing Committee, Jim Harms, Kevin Oderman, Marianne Salmon, Ethel Morgan Smith, Alyssa High, and Glenn Taylor, thank you very much for being here. It's an honor to present Valerie Neiman, who is the author of a collection of short stories, Fidelities, from West Virginia University Press, a poetry collection, Wake, 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 and her most recent book, Blood Clay, a novel. She has received an NEA Creative Writing Fellowship, 2 Elizabeth Simpson Smith Prizes in Fiction, and the Greg Grummer Prize in Poetry. A native of Western New York State, she graduated from WVU and the MFA program at Queens University of Charlotte. She teaches writing at North Carolina A&T State University and is the poetry editor of Prime Number magazine. Valerie's novel has been receiving high marks from journals, newspapers, and fellow writers. Novelist Elizabeth Stuckey French says, "Blood Clay has it all." Fiction writer Pinckney Benedict says, "Books this fine are very rare indeed." And from the Charleston Gazette Mail, "Not only her nuanced plot, setting, and characters, but also Neiman's poetic language brings her world to life. She paints the setting with precise, laser-cut visuals. Neiman's journalistic background shows in her tight economy of construction. She offers a near-sociological view of the world, involves the reader deeply with several characters, and provides true, aching insights about identity, both personal and cultural, and she does so in fewer than 200 pages. Not a word, image, or event is wasted." Please welcome Valerie Neiman.
Thank you so much. And I'm going to do one quick little bit of business. Well, I'm really happy to be here and be back at WVU, and you can thank Professor Paul Atkins and the Journalism Department for teaching me to not waste a word, because I had that certainly drilled into me, that if a word is wasted, then you get rid of it. And so, yes, the book is fairly slender with a lot packed into it, as people have pointed out. I guess that's just my nature. Am I supposed to stand in front of this one or this
Whatever
one?
Whatever you feel most comfortable.
Okay. I could wander around. Okay. I was really pleased when West Virginia University Press put out Fidelities some years ago, and it's still in print, luckily and thankfully to them. And they put it up on an ebook recently, which was also really, really nice. And Blood Clay came out in March of this year, and I've been kind of going around doing all of these things. So I'm not going to stand up here too much. I'm going to come around because I hate feeling like I'm teaching a class. I do teach at North Carolina A&T. I'm able to teach creative writing there, which is a great pleasure. Undergraduate, so I'm getting people when they're just freshly getting into writing, when it's still, you know, I don't know if I can do this. And that's kind of fun because, you know, I get to work with them as they're just really exploring. I enjoy that a lot. I thought I'd start with a poem just to kind of open things up. This was a recent poem, a guzzle, which are getting to be popular. Y'all familiar with guzzles? Anyone? It's an Arabic form and uses a repetition of the end of the line as the way of pulling it together, but it's intended to be individual couplets which can stand on their own, but the poem as a whole, when you read through the couplets, then create a whole picture. So it's a really fun form. And this was something I saw from the side of the road down in North Carolina, or at least the house. I saw a house planted in a field, and so I wrote this. She comes home to a house planted in a field. In the quiet after rain, he says that sound is corn growing and the soil sucking water from the sky. She sees uncountable tongues begin to recoil. Crickets in the fall are singing for sex, he tells her, singing with their knees. She pulls away, holding her legs straight between the sheets, beginning to recoil. She finds the head of a rabbit. A fox, he says, stashed it behind the hay bale for leaner days. Such bloody harvest. At the sight of their house, she begins to recoil. Winter arrives with Orion. He joins the hunters on the hillside, their orange hides moving slowly until they raise their rifles and their bodies learn to recoil. Green spears of squill she planted and forgot come through the cold dirt, sepals open, and from thrusting pistols and stamens, blue petals begin to recoil. When the corn stands high and strong, she walks barefoot into the fields. Out of sight of that square house, some muscular part of her begins to recoil. So I had some fun doing that. And yeah, literally I saw this house that was planted with the crops nearly all the way around it, just a little path through them. And it just, for some reason, stayed with me for a long time. So blood clay. The story of blood clay is a story about learning to be part of a community or trying to be. A woman from Pennsylvania, Ohio, Tracy Gaines, has gone through a rough divorce and moved south, decides she's going to North Carolina, gets a job at an alternative school, and wants very much to be part of this community. And so she buys an old ramshackle farmhouse, and she's busy restoring it, and really, really loves this place, wants so much to be part of it. She witnesses a violent attack on a child by a pack of dogs. And her reaction and what happens thereafter is what forms the body of the book. She ends up at odds with the community. And other people are also in this position of trying to find their place. One of her fellow teachers, Dave, is a native son who then moved away to sort of go out and save the world and ended up having to come home after he suffers his own personal trauma. And other neighbors are people who've come home, Artis and his son coming home after a divorce and coming home to the parents' place, or a woman who lives with an old man and woman and helps him keep the farm alive, and she's trying to make a home there. So the characters are all in some way working on this process of finding home. So I'm going to start with the bang, the thing that gets the book off to a start, and then I'm going to read a couple of short sections from later in the book as Tracy's trying to learn to negotiate this place, and she just kind of doesn't quite, she's not quite meshing. So I'll jump around just a little bit. Tracy was chilled when she got in her car, having seen the last of the students onto the buses and the last of the buses onto Highway 343. The bright day had faded. Despite the sun in the tops of the trees, the wind had kicked up and purple clouds were spreading from the north like a new risen ridge of mountains. The NPR announcer spoke low and clear. No crisis so great it couldn't be reported in calmness. National Therapy Radio, she called it, the same kind of soothing voice, the same impersonal reassurance. She tried to think what she had at home for dinner, but couldn't focus. Something. She had a bundle of papers to grade, a test to prepare. Food would be secondary. Tracy recognized her old enemy, the exhaustion that made her sit down on the couch, then lie down, then nap and wake more tired than before. It chewed up her concentration and swallowed her confidence. She couldn't place the reason for it. Winter was gone, and though this evening the clouds had quickly gathered up the sun, the days were starting to get longer. No particular memory was attached to this time of year. No happy time with Carl, nor sadness of some loss, nothing to pull her down. She turned onto the secondary road, pine woods to the left, fields and a farm on the right. She caught up with the bus on Burnt Cabin Road at the usual place. Number 41 had taken its circuitous route through the county and was nearly empty as it wallowed over the low hills. Two kids got off at a shotgun house painted an amazing shade of gloss marine blue. Four children scattered to waiting cars at Macklin Crossroads. The next stop was the trailer court for Lakeisha, and then the bus would roll past her driveway empty. The stop sign swung out and the bus lights flashed. Tracy listened to an interview with a man who played the glass harmonica. She stared out her side window. Four big dogs loped across the field, headed somewhere. not hounds. A massive dark dog was in the lead, head up as though following something by sight rather than scent. Lakeisha hopped off the last step and went back up the road to the row of mailboxes. The driver kept his lights flashing while she pulled down the door, peered inside, then pushed the rusty door closed with both hands. She trudged back to the trailer park lane. Her white jacket glowed in the dim light. In her rearview mirror, Tracy saw the dogs again, breaking into a run as they crossed the road behind her car. She looked over, expecting to see deer in the plowed field on the other side, but it was empty. The school bus lurched forward over the rise. She let off the brake, wanting to be home. Movement caught her eye again. The dogs were running hard. Lakeisha dawdled up the sandy road, swinging her book bag by its strap. Tracy put down the window. Lakeisha, the girl waved, then opened up a smile and headed back for the highway. Tracy kept an eye on the dogs, worried they would frighten her. "Hey, dogs," Tracy yelled. She whistled, but the dogs didn't heed. Now Lakeisha saw them. She shrieked and flailed her arms. The dogs angled toward the girl, and now she began to run. She threw her bag at them, and the lead dog snatched it up, shook it hard one time the way dogs kill groundhogs, one hard snap, and then tossed it aside. The car had drifted almost to the ditch. Tracy turned the wheel and hit the gas, honked the horn, screamed out the window as Lakeisha stumbled backward, fell, and the dogs were on her. Tracy inched the car forward, trying to back them off, but when one moved, the others came on, and she couldn't tell how close she was to where Lakeisha had gone down. As Tracy opened the door, a dog pushed its lug head into the gap, snapping, snarling, with blood on its muzzle. She slammed the door hard on its skull twice before it howled and retreated. Her knees were shaking, her hands were numb. She honked and honked. The bus was gone. The trailers were dark, even the one at the end where Lakeisha lived. The Chevy in the drive, but the house closed up, the drapes pulled. A black dog clawed at the door, a machine gun sound, and lunged into the open window, teeth bared. Tracy threw herself across the seat, out of reach. No one on the road. No one in the raw red fields. The dogs somewhere out of sight. And she heard a growl, but nothing from the girl. Tracy hit reverse, backing into the road, bouncing and shifting, accelerating as she turned into her lane, the car banging over the ruts, her head hitting the roof. She stopped nearly against the porch, digging in her pocketbook for the keys as she ran up the steps. She banged open the screen door, jammed, jabbed, twisted the key in. 911. "Saul County Communications," the dispatcher drawled. "Is this an emergency?" "Yes. Yes, dogs attacking a little girl, Downey Trailer Park, Burnt Cabin Road, Downey Park. Are you with the child?" "Yes, no, I'm calling, I'm a neighbor." She heard the dispatcher summon police, ambulance, the repeated address, all calm, all steady, as she dropped the phone. Tracy slewed the car around in the drive and headed back. All she could see was a white coat, Lakeisha's face, snarling dogs. At the lane into the silent trailer park, nothing. The dogs were gone. The girl gone. She sat for a moment. Had she imagined it? She opened the door. Cold night was closing in. Wind bent over the bleached heads of last year's weeds. No dogs. No Lakeisha. The trailer's dark. Tracy got out, leaving the car running, the headlights fanning across the road and the first of the trailers. She heard the repeated chime from the open door, heard sand grind under her heels, heard an airplane droning toward the county airstrip. She saw where her wheels had spun as she backed out, then a dark streak. She bent, touched it, black on the coarse sand, but when she raised her hand to the headlight beam, her fingertips were red. And so Tracy is the lone witness to this attack. And she recognizes the dogs. And so I'm going to read just a little piece. She has lives in this place. With one side, there are a group of mobile homes, which are generally occupied by Latino laborers who come seasonally. Only Lakeisha's family lives there year-round permanently. And on the other side is the home place of Artis and his mother and his son, Jim. Who's one of the students at the alternative school. And she has met artists on a couple of occasions. They were artists' dogs. Yes, she was sure. She remembered them slobbering over the side of the truck last October as she went into the post office. The population around Taborville was too small and spread out to allow for route delivery, so people had to pick up their mail. She was waiting on the clerks to finish sorting it into boxes when artist Pennell came in, flashing that wide smile. "Too hot for this late in the year," she offered. "Yeah, but tobacco's gone to market and there's only the fall plowing." He opened one of the large boxes on the bottom row, lifted a thick stack of mail onto the counter, and began to pitch the junk into the trash can with a smooth flick of his wrist. Tracy had thought about him more and more in recent months. He was a few years older, with a little more gray in his dark hair than hers, a little bit of paunch. Like her, he was divorced, but with a son. Artis had moved back to his parents' place. They were alike in that, too, turning to country life and what it could do to ease the loss. The clerk thrust two bills and a penny pincher into her box. Artis was still sorting as she walked past, and she lingered outside, reading a rummage sale notice tacked to the power pole. She smiled when he came out and felt a little jolt when he stayed to talk, his two big dogs behind him panting and turning around in the truck bed. "How are things coming on the old place?" he asked. His blue eyes were bright, agreeable, nested in crow's feet crinkled against the sun. "All right, I'm fighting the plumbing right now." Artis nodded, his lips pursed for a moment as though he was considering something. She plunged ahead, encouraged by the casual way he eased his back away from the side of the truck, refusing to listen to that voice in her head reminding her, "No more men, no more men. You come over for a glass of sweet tea sometime and I'll show you my handiwork." His smile faded to an open-mouthed gape. "Oh, honey," he said, "let's just stay neighbors. You got way too much cat in you for a hound like me." So Tracy doesn't quite get the way things are in North Carolina. As someone who relocated from West Virginia, not Ohio, but West Virginia to North Carolina, my encounters, at first I didn't understand because I was in a rural county like this and I drive along and people are all like, and I'm thinking, they must think I'm somebody else. And I'm thinking, well, my truck really doesn't look, it had a big eagle on the side of it, it was kind of gaudy. And I'm thinking, well, it can't possibly be another truck like this. And then I just realized people do this. People are very open, and that took a while to get used to. So I was drawing on my own experiences. You'd be in line at the supermarket, and the woman behind you would start telling me about her appendix operation or her son who was in jail or things. I'm sort of like, is this all right? Because I wasn't used to that. As open and friendly as West Virginians are, they are nothing on North Carolina. They will tell you anything and everything. And I've gotten used to that, and I love it. I love that openness. And I think when I was a kid and I watched Andy Griffith, and we used to laugh at all of that, it's really like that. It really still is. They call North Carolina the veil of humility between two peaks of arrogance. It really is that people are just so nice. And it takes a while to get used to that, but they are so willing to share and be open and be kind in those kind of ways. And she's a bit distrustful, not only has she come from Ohio, Pennsylvania, but she's also gone through a lot of, you know, psychic trauma, and she's kind of, you know, very brittle, and so she doesn't pick up well. I wanted to read one more piece because I don't want to read too long, but this is where she's dealing with one of her fellow teachers, Dave, who has become a friend. He teaches in a classroom near her, and he has his own problems. He himself has also been wounded and is facing his own kinds of difficulties. So I'm just going to read a little bit of this. He has had a rough day. He has Jim Pennell, the son of artists, in his classroom. And Jim is angry. He's an angry young man. And in fact, he has a classroom full of angry teenage boys who are in this alternative school for all sorts of reasons, and they're not happy about being there. And so Jim had given him a rough time, and he kind of looks for refuge. He shows up out at Tracy's place, and she's sitting on the porch, and this is the first time he's been there. There are all these bottles lined up on the railing. And he said, "Where are these?" He picks one up, and she said, "Well, I dig in the dump." and starts to explain that. I found it down in the farm dump. I guess an archaeologist would call it a midden. He had a vision of Tracy in khaki, auburn hair streaming from under a pith helmet, excavating an Egyptian statue from a pile of sand. I was wandering around right after I bought this place, looking up in the trees like a goober, she admitted, laughing. And when I stepped, the whole area just caved in under me. Dave squinted, thinking about a slide through old garbage. It wasn't so bad, she said, picking up on his thoughts. It hadn't been used since the 50s, at least. I kicked around a bit and turned up one of these old bottles. That's when I knew it must have been a dump from way back, and I got excited. I used to do this in Ohio. Dumpster diving? Give me a break, she said. Come on, I'll show you. She dove into a patch of woods where the ground sloped toward a little stream, and the dump straggled down that slope toward the resting place of an ancient refrigerator and two rusted wagon wheels. Tracy stopped and spread her arms like she was opening the gates to an elegant garden. And oddly enough, Dave could almost see it that way. Trilliums raised white triangles over the leaf litter, and Virginia bluebells and other glimmering pale flowers he couldn't name seemed all the more brilliant in the dim afternoon light. Dogwood spread white layers of blossoms among the leafing branches of bigger trees. The dump site was lumpy from her digging, some of it covered with last fall's leaves and some of it freshly opened, the thin layer of loam split down to Carolina red clay. I figured out where the older stuff is over here, she said, grabbing a short-handled shovel that leaned into the crotch of a tree. And she starts digging, and she kind of forgets Dave's there. You know, she gets so excited by what she's finding. She finds a little stoneware bowl, which is actually a memory of finding a little bowl like that on the place I lived. I lived over near Farmington on top of a mountain where they used to take the leavings from restaurants in Fairmont and take them out and dump them for the pigs. There was a big pig farm there. And so when you dig, you turn up spoons and bottles and bones and oyster shells, lots of oyster shells. Must have been a high-end restaurant. And little bowls sometimes. And so I have this very little bowl with the little purple flowers around it. And so I put it in here. And she finds a cobalt bottle. And he asks how old it is. And she says maybe turn of the century. She rubbed the bottle on her shirt. It was the color of, he tried to place it, ocean night. Clear moonless sky over tropical ocean, maybe that came close. Tracy turned the bottle in her hand, buffed it on her shirt like an apple she was preparing to eat. So how far back do we go here? How long have people been here? The native population was Cashy, Saponi, then colonial settlement, English, German coming in from the coast, Quakersdom coming down the wagon road from Pennsylvania. The Revolution, you know there was a major battle west of here, the Battle of Guilford Courthouse. General Greene let Cornwallis chase him back and forth till his army was worn down and sick. That's why he lost at Yorktown, you know. Tracy nodded. He imagined she knew most all of this from books, as he knew it from family stories and roadside plaques studied from the backseat of the Mercury. Where I grew up, you'd never know the revolution was fought on the Valley Forge, she said, kicking lightly at some excavated earth. So there might be things there that far back? Probably not. There wasn't any real farming out here till the early 1800s. Tobacco, corn, little cotton. Slaves. Yes, but in a smaller way than on the coast or in the deep south. I don't imagine they noticed the difference. Dave flushed. I imagine they did. Read up on the rice plantations or the canal building in the Dismal Swamp, the malaria, the snakes. This region was half settled by Quakers and Mennonites, troublemakers, abolitionists. Jefferson Davis despaired of maintaining control here. It was a lot more complicated than it seems. Tracy started digging again. He saw how her lips were compressed, holding something back, and wondered if he'd sounded like some kind of rebel apologist. But a stubborn streak wouldn't let him say as much. Instead, he knelt on the broken ground and began to poke through the dirt that came flying way too fast from the hole Tracy was excavating. As he started to toss aside a clump, a flash of white showed among the rubby roots, and he pulled it back. He broke the clump apart carefully until he saw what it was, a carved flower nestled among the roots like the inversions of reality that make sense in dreams. And they examine it, and she says she thinks it's ivory, sort of a wild rose, maybe a brooch or a button. So she's easing her back, and he says, I could use a stretch too. He used a tree as a cat handhold to help him sit down where the slope was clear of cat wire. his feet pushed out stiffly between clusters of bluebells. Tracy sat down, still intent on her find. She rubbed some of the crust from the flower. She turned it over and back, spit on her fingers, and rubbed at it. Here he was, sitting on a flowered bank beside a beautiful country-bred lass who wasn't afraid to spit. He could hear Oberon's song. I know a bank where the wild thyme blows, where oxlips and nodding violet grows. And he considered her fine straight nose and elegant lips and thought he might as well be bottom, wearing the mule's head well suited to his nature. So how old is this farm? Early 19th century. It was all part of the Chalmers holding. She nodded in recognition of a name found all over the county. Four big plantations were made out of the original survey. This part was the Pettigrews. After the war, the plantations were broken up. Abner Pettigrew was in the Confederate government, and he lost his property. But the family hung onto parts of it through purchase. The Floyds, who bought what you know now as the Floyd place, your place, were a collateral line. You know a lot for an English teacher. Family history, he said, then regretted that. He didn't want to think that he was a snob for his Pettigrew roots. I surely am from around here. He smiled, and she did too, and Dave felt the swell of unexpected pride. This was his place, and the yeasty smell of open ground was as good as bread baking in the kitchen. I guess you get tired of Yankees. He shrugged. Just the ones who come here for the weather and criticize everything else. The criticism is all right. Things aren't perfect. It's just the stereotypes, the idea that things haven't changed in the South. It doesn't help when people see a Confederate flag flying. He wasn't going to go there. Instead, he began to talk about how, despite the past, that blacks and whites lived and worked together a lot closer here than in the North. This is how I put it. You tell me how many black friends you had up north. Not people you worked with, friends, people who came to your house, people you visited. Tracy sat forward and wrapped her arms around her knees. Where I grew up, there weren't any black people, just White Sox farmers. We're all bound together. It's like the names, the Black Chalmerses and the White Chalmerses, the White Floyds and the Black Floyds. It goes a long way back, and yes, there's a lot of pain, but this is our home, our land. We come out of the same red dirt, blood and clay. She looked through the trees toward the open field. I wonder, she began, then stopped. I wonder what the Black Chalmerses think when they look at the big houses and the fields and the farms. I mean, they built all of that. They made it, and it's beautiful. And in some ways, I guess I'd be proud, but it's not theirs. So that's her dealing with, starting to deal with the very complex legacy of the South. And it's something that is a lot more complicated than perhaps the stereotypes of North or South would indicate. In this particular area, which is based loosely on the Piedmont area where I live, it was in fact settled a lot by Quakers and Mennonites, and also a strong Jewish contingent who came in and built the textile mills. And so the legacy of Greensboro is that there was, race relations were not, they were in fact segregated, but when desegregation happened, it was much less violent and much more calm. And so people tend to think, well, it was not so bad here, and so there's a lot of silences. People don't talk about the past as much as they should, but Tracy is wanting to dig and uncover. And so Dave has to start confronting some of his past, his family's past, his ideas, and the thing that's troubling him, which is that he worries that after he has suffered the attack that he suffered, that he is now becoming a racist. So he is having to actually sort of confront his issues as she is trying to understand things beyond stereotypes herself. One thing I enjoyed working with in here was working with the tobacco industry. And yeah, tobacco's bad. You know, don't smoke. Whatever you do, don't smoke. But the plant itself is rather lovely. Anyone come from tobacco country here? It's an interesting thing because unlike the kind of crops I'm used to, where you put the corn in the ground, the corn comes up, it grows, you harvest it. Tobacco is almost like a baby. You put the seed in little things in the greenhouse and you raise up the little plant, and then they take the little plant into the fields and they set it in the rows individually, and it needs to be tended individually. And then when it is harvested leaf at a time. Go in and pull the leaves individually. And then they traditionally were bound into hands and hung on sticks and taken to the barns where they were cured over heat. And then they were taken to market in giant burlaps. And they would put these burlaps on the floor, and you would see this beautiful tobacco, which is all shades of beautiful brown and caramel and gold and really attractive looking stuff, and smell good. And the auction would take place with an entourage. And this was really something to see, of the auctioneer going through, followed by people who recorded the sale, and a woman with a whole bundle of beautiful silk ribbons in different colors. And as the various representatives of Reynolds or American or Diamond or different places would bid on the tobacco, whoever won it, they had a specific colored ribbon, so they'd throw these ribbons on piles. You see blue and red and gold flying through the air onto these piles. It was a lovely thing to see. And the auctioneers chant, and of course it was like homecoming. All the families coming in with their tobacco, selling the tobacco, getting their money for the year. That's gone away in the time since I went to North Carolina. Now the tobacco is cured and then it is baled like hay and taken away on trucks and sold by contract. The auctions are gone. The wagons trundling down the road with these giant burlap bundles is gone. And it's a loss of a whole way of life that had its ups and downs, but certainly was woven in the fabric. Kind of like if coal left West Virginia. There's a lot of bad weather, a lot of problems, but think of what it would do to sort of the identity of the people if it suddenly disappeared in some way. So that's sort of threaded through the book. I'm gonna read maybe just a little piece of that, and then we'll just have a chance to talk. If I have a chapter here that shows some of the tobacco. I left my book in the car. They had all my little markers in it, and I'm ashamed of that, so I've got to find out where I am. There it is. This is another confrontation with artists, and I'll just set it up. She's driving home after helping Dave paint his kitchen, and she comes up this back way through this dirt road, and she realizes it's artists in the field with a few Latino laborers and his son, and they're taking the flower tops off. Tobacco, which they used to do by hand, now they pretty much do it by chemicals. And he sees her go by, and he kicks a rock. Tracy shoved the shifter into park and turned off the car. She found where the rock had hit. Under the dust, the paint was marked. What do you think you're doing? She leaped across the water in the ditch. Did nothing ever drain here? And her paint-spotted shoes sank as she walked across the tilled ground. Artis hung his head and his mouth tightened in chagrin. She heard him say something to the man in soft Spanish. I didn't mean that. Well, it was a hell of a kick not to mean it. I just got the other side repainted. Somebody had keyed her car at this school. Artis held up his hands, palms up. I'm sorry, I'm really sorry. I don't know why I did that, really. Tracy snorted. What am I supposed to say? Frustration prickled in his voice. You could say you'll pay to have it fixed. He looked over her shoulder and she saw where Jim was coming from the pickup, cradling an aluminum jug. Hi, Jim, she said, controlling her voice. Hey. Jim went to his father and waited as Artis tipped back the jug and took a long drink. She realized how his face was just beginning to hone down, becoming sharp where it had been soft and childish. Artis unrolled a box of Winston's from his shirt sleeve. Nice of Miss Gaines to stop and say hello to us, isn't it? She bit her lip. Boy didn't need to get into this. You're helping in the field? He bent his head. It's Saturday, I don't believe he's truant. Artis tossed the match and blew out a long whistle of smoke. I didn't mean yet. Come auction time, might be he'll have a flu bug. She smiled gamely to show she wasn't baffled by his tone shifting back and forth from contrition to mockery to gaiety. I understand that happens when the tobacco's ready. It was deer season that emptied the schools where I came from. Ohio. Yes. Bit different up there. Tracy barely heard. He'd mentioned Ohio. Remembered, made a gesture. She kept going. Things are different, yes. He looked closely at her, his eyes squinted against the sun. He motioned Jim to follow the laborers up the field. "I'm sorry that misunderstandings have come between us when we should be neighbors." Oh, there it was. She heard the echo in her words. "Neighbors," his voice slapping at her. "Let's just be neighbors." Artis stood with one arm across his chest and the other set against it, and the cigarette smoldering at chin level. "So I'll say I'm sorry for the rock, and I am. You have anything to say to me?" From his stance, she realized too late that he wasn't offering peace. He was expecting surrender. "Artis, it's not about you or me. I had to tell what I saw. Lakeisha deserves that. What makes you so damn sure of yourself?" Tracy wasn't sure she heard what she heard. Sure of herself, she doubted everything. Doubted if she'd locked the door every morning or turned off the coffee pot. She couldn't tell him how unsure she was about everything but that night and those dogs. Those dogs she knew. "I have to tell what happened." "Well, you go on then and you do what you gotta do. As far as that rock, send me the bill. You might try Gregory's Body Shop. They'll do a better job and charge you half what the dealership did." The keying on the side of her car, she comes to realize, was done by Jim. Jim is pretty hostile. Artis picked up a handful of red dirt and rubbed it between his palms. It clung to his skin, sticking to the sap from the broken flowers. "I didn't know you had land over here." "McGraw owns this. His widow does now. I'm not the quota holder." She had learned about quota, federal permission to plant, but there was nothing useful she could say. "2 acres here," he said. "Used to bring in $3,000. Who knows this year?" Tracy looked at the small field, the heavy plumed leaves like in the colonial drawings of Indians carrying tobacco that she had studied. Just such red Indians and lush tobacco leaves on the Saul County flag. "It looks like a good stand," she said. "Good crop. The praise for Ohio corn didn't fit here. The words didn't match the thick leaves and the blossom smell and the sharp, raw sap scent that blew toward her. A patch of tobacco put a lot of kids through Carolina. Me, for one. But I figure Jim won't have that help if he gets that far." Something about the way he stood, feet planted, arms akimbo, and his face turned to follow the path of his son. Tracy thought he looked so much the image of this land. His sunburned arms, and yes, the soft of his stomach, a poster from the Depression or a photograph, grown out of this soil. She almost reached toward him, impulsively needing him to accept her presence, accept her. In some way, he held a key to her becoming part of this place. The native son returned, knit into the community as though he'd never left. She was the newcomer who always seemed to be standing in the diner door, searching among the tables for a face to greet hers. If artists gestured her inside, the smiles would be genuine and the offers heartfelt. And in the same imagining, she could see Dave sitting by himself, bent over his loneliness, an outsider in his own home place.